It's interesting how over the days we're kind of filling up more and more of the space. Also, it feels a little bit like you're getting further and further away. Interesting kind of reconfiguration. I'd like to I'll continue a thread that Nathan started exploring yesterday. And kind of picking it up with that discernment, that wisdom that can see, can notice the appearance of dukkha. I can see how dukkha has come to be. I can see that dukkha can cease, can resolve, can dissolve, and can see the path leading to the cessation of dukkha. Yeah. So Nirodha, by the way, means cessation. Just can't help but say that. Yeah, the cessation of dukkha. And so this kind of this thread is something that, of course, you know, these are the Four Noble Truths. This is what the teachings are really pointing towards and encouraging us to explore. And over the days here, that's really what we've been doing. We've been looking into the ways that dukkha constructs and builds, or in the words of that quote from yesterday, looking at the ways that dukkha comes to be. And I think I have touched on this. I think we both have. Seeing that process from the contact through our sense doors to the Vedana, and that building up from the Vedana, the craving, the clinging, the demand, you know, push-pull, and how all of that escalation of reactivity and of demand is already dukkha and builds more and more, builds more and more dukkha. So we've been looking at this and kind of repeating this because, yeah, it's something that we need to see again and again, over and over. We need to kind of mull on, you know, chew, digest, feel how this unfolds in our own experience. We've been looking at that and exploring that, and we've also very much been exploring practices that reduce, you know, or counteract this process of dukkha building. Mm. It's very much kind of what we've been doing, and it's such a beautiful aspect of these teachings and these practices, you know, that we can practice in ways that nurture, that nourish, that reveal and cultivate well-being. And I know it's not like we're all floating on clouds of well-being all the time. There's quite a lot of challenge and difficulty. But there's moments and there's that sense of the cultivation. And we can reflect and see, you know, how do these practices work? What do they do? How do they reduce or counteract the building of dukkha? There was a beautiful question in one of the Q&As about this, you know, about, you know, is it that in metta practice, you know, it's part of what's happening that we're letting go? And it's like, yes, it is. You know, what are we letting go of? We're letting go of that process of building stress and distress and ill-being. There's a letting go of those building blocks of that. That's part of what feels good, feels nourishing, brings ease with the metta. So all the practices that we've been exploring, they support non-reactivity, the opposite of reactivity, non-demand. They lessen and dissolve dukkha from the root, and they nourish and deepen its opposite. So another way of saying this, the well-being that we experience in practice, whether it's through metta, whether it's through the gatheredness of samadhi, whether it's through, the insight ways of looking that can bring relief and release. The well-being that we experience, it comes through relaxing that push-pull on experience. Yeah. Releasing, reducing the demand and the clinging. I'm doing this. We'll get to this. Maybe we'll get to it now. It's funny how like my body is kind of participating along with the talks, with the words, and we talk about demand and I do this. Because it's like the demand of, the push-pull of the clenched fist. Yeah, it's a beautiful image, which is, we feel it, that contractedness of the holding on, grabbing onto things, trying to pull them towards us and to keep them. And then the pushing away, the struggle, the rejection. And so kind of the practices that we're doing here, they relax that. So that clenched fist can, relax and open to the open hand. Relax and open to the open hand, which, maybe you could get a sense of that in the practices we were doing today. Right? Both in the morning and in the afternoon, that open hand of metta. Just anything that arises, welcome to appear, welcome to be. Yeah? Welcome to go in its time. Just an open hand. So the well-being comes through that relaxing of the clenched fist, comes through that letting go of the clinging. And when we say clinging and craving, it includes the aversion. Yeah, there's the grasping after, there's the pushing away. Both those movements are part of that. Or we can say the well-being comes through building less. Yeah, through building less in experience. So another thing that we've kind of been repeating, and is again, it like that insight needs to go deeper and deeper into our being, the well-being or the ill-being, the satisfaction or the discontent are not contained in things. Yeah. We sometimes give this example that, we've spent a lot of our adult lives in India, and sometimes, I don't know, I haven't been to India now for a few years, but I'm guessing these are still around. You can buy a carton of juice and it says on it, or a bottle says, does not contain fruit. It's like mango juice or whatever. It does not contain fruit. 100% fruitless. Yeah. And it's like that kind of label that we need, along with the Safe Zone t-shirt. We need to have that, we can, this post-it notes that we have by the notice board, start putting them on things. That does not contain satisfaction. Yeah. Does not contain dissatisfaction. It's great that you're laughing because that's part of what it does, it reminds us, of the way that we just kind of project that onto things. So the well-being or the ill-being, the satisfaction or the discontent, they're not contained in objects. They're not contained in things, including, in us as human beings or other beings. They're very much dependent on the way of relating. Very much dependent on the way of relating. Okay, I didn't mean to tell this story, but I'm going to tell a story. an example of this. I'm just remembering it and thinking, I haven't told this one in a while. So then I'm the storyteller in me kind of wants to bring it in. So this is a fairly recent one, so it hasn't been told in too many talks yet. I'm saying that to the recording. So this was a few months ago, I can't even remember when. Nathan and I were teaching a meditation and action day in London. We do meditation and action retreats, so we were spent the day in a really beautiful project that we've been working with a lot, and they kind of have a wild woodland in the middle of the city, which used to be a cemetery. It's a very special place. So we were there for the day with a group working, and when we got ready, you know, we kind of gathered in the main building, and we had all our bags because we were on the way from one place to the other, as we often are. And as we were getting ready to kind of lock up and go out to the conservation area to do some work, I said to Nathan, oh, let's put our laptops in the locker. And usually we just leave them there in a bag. And so we did. Had a wonderful day. A lot of beautiful practice there, working, taking care of the place, meditating together, community. End of the day, we caught the tube to the train station and waited for our train, and sitting there on a bench, and then they announced our train had a platform, and we got up to go to the platform. Nathan picked up his bag and put it on, and said to me, why is my bag so light? Yeah. Because the laptops are still in the locker in Tower Hamlet Cemetery Park across London, where there's nobody there now because they've all gone home. We're about to get on our train home, which is a 3-hour journey. And so we're standing there looking at each other. And I said to Nathan, oh, thank goodness you remembered before we got on the train. Yeah. And what do we do now? So, why am I telling you the story? Because the well-being or the ill-being is not in the object. It's in the way of relating. Yeah. So it's not the fact that we've left the laptops in the lockers and will now need to spend another night in London and get them the next day. Yeah, it's in the way of relating. There was no dukkha in that experience. Yeah. There was no dukkha in that experience. And you know, I tell it to you like this. It's obviously not a nice thing, right? Your plans change. You have to stay in the big city another night. Yeah, and all of that, get home a day later. All of that. But it's in the way of relating. In the way of relating because of cultivating. Yeah, the mind, the way of relating is gratitude. Yeah. That comes up naturally, yeah, in that moment. Yeah. In that moment. Yeah. Gratitude that we're not on the train yet. Gratitude that we, you know, have somewhere to stay. Yeah. Gratitude that there's nothing the next day that can't be put off. You know, there's lots of things that we can be grateful for, but it's in the way of relating. And, you know, on a different day, and let's just be really clear, on a different day, in different conditions, it could have looked different, right? Why did you forget the laptops? Why did you tell me to put them in the locker? Or whatever, yeah? All of that could have unfolded. Yeah? So the difference between dukkha and non-dukkha, in the way of relating, is not in the thing. Yeah, not in the thing. I hope that makes sense. Yeah? As an example.
But did you get the laptops?
Yeah, the next day.
Oh.
Yeah. They were safe in the locker. They spent the night in a beautiful place. And the next day we got to see our friend who runs the project briefly again and to go home. Yeah. So we can also kind of see this in our own experience, yeah, here on retreat. And, you know, maybe You know, I'm just going to ask this and see, did anyone notice anything interesting happening to your uncomfortable sensations when we were practicing offering the metta this afternoon? Anything interesting happened to the unpleasant sensations? Yes.
Should I answer?
If you want to, yeah.
I actually realized I can offer metta to my mind, which had been troubling me.
Yeah.
And it dissolved.
And it dissolved. Yeah. Yeah, so yeah, some of you, you're not the first one. Okay, took the practice even further than the physical sensations. And great that you did that. And then noticing that bringing metta to, you know, thoughts that were troublesome just dissolved them. Yeah. Yeah. Anyone else? Anything? Oh, we'll go with that one. That's a good one. Yeah. So, you know, we can see sometimes we can bring a different way of relating to something that seems fixed. Yeah, this is unpleasant, or this is troublesome, yeah, or this is difficult. And we change the way of relating from the habit of pushing it away, yeah, to compassion, to metta. Yeah. And the thing itself can change. The thing itself can change. So the ill being or the well-being, it's not in the object, it's in the way of relating. And this is, you know, such an important insight that we kind of keep practicing for. So these little kind of moments, you know, maybe we bring a sense of metta to a painful sensation and it disappears, or to a troublesome thought and it disappears, or it changes, yeah. They can seem small in the moment. You know, I might say, well, so what? Yeah. There's a few whats there. You know, one is the insight. You know, we want to kind of squeeze the nectar of the insight out of that. And it can be our own experience or someone else's. Yeah. And we kind of squeeze the insight out of that. What does that mean about our experience? But also, as we keep practicing with this, as we keep bringing these insights into being through how we practice and attend to our experience, our skill grows, yeah, at doing that, our capacity grows, and our confidence grows. Yeah. Confidence in these teachings, our confidence in the practice, our confidence in our own capacity, yeah, to walk this path, and to apply these teachings, and to grow as we do so. So this kind of understanding that the well-being or ill-being, satisfaction or discontent are not contained in the object. Yeah, they're dependent on the way of relating. This opens up so much possibilities and so much freedom for us. And these questions, yeah, like Nathan was saying yesterday, these practice questions that the Buddha offered to us, and other teachers over time and practitioners have offered to us. You know, when dukkha is there, what else is there? Yeah. On what does dukkha depend? We want to see what are the other factors that are there when there's dukkha. And as I said, we've touched on them already. Yeah. That escalation from the Vedana to the Tanha, that thirst, that craving, that clinging, that push-pull and the clenched fist on experience, all of that is dukkha. And something else that is there that we've been mentioning and I want to spend a little bit more time with is contraction. Yeah. When dukkha is there, there is contraction. Sometimes that contraction will be clearly felt, yeah, through the physical body. Sometimes that contraction will be felt in the more subtle body or the energy body. Yeah. Yeah. Might feel like areas that are numb or dense, now contracted, just might feel like a shrinking of that, you know, space around something. And sometimes we can feel the contraction in the awareness, you know, that will shrink around, you know, something, that will get smaller, you know, more limited. So all of these, the demand, the push-pull, the craving, clinging, and the contraction, they're all levers that we can work with to lessen the experience of dukkha. Sometimes we use this image, they're like a, you know, mixer desk with all these levers. Yeah, and you, one goes down, they all go down. We kind of relax that clenched fist, the dukkha goes down, the demand goes down, the craving goes down. We relax the contraction, all the rest go down. They all come together. They're in relationship with each other. And any of them can be a lever. Yeah, can be something that we work with to bring down the level of dukkha in our experience. And again, this is true of all the practices that we've been doing. When we kind of just come back to the anchor of attention, that's what we're doing. We're reducing that push-pull, that kind of going off to here or trying to grab that. Just through that coming back to the anchor, we don't feed the push-pull, and we're dissolving the habits of push-pull, of clinging and grasping over time. When we practice something like wise acceptance, it's like this right now. And it's dependently originating. And what can I do? What are we doing? We're, again, relaxing. And kind of bringing down those levers that build dukkha. When we practice metta. Or tuning into well-being. Or the way we were practicing today with the Vedana. Or seeing the dynamic nature of experience, like we were doing yesterday and today. All of these bring interest into the experience. We're changing something in that dynamic, and all of these dukkha builders begin to go down. When we don't follow the habit of the push-pull, again, what we were doing this morning, but actually go against the stream of our conditioning, instead of pushing away and rejecting the unpleasant, turn to it with compassion and with care. Instead of trying to grab on or hold on to what is pleasant, we appreciate it. It's interesting to see and to reflect for ourselves what happens to the degree of contraction there, what happens to the degree of demand, and what happens to the degree of dukkha. So this is the common thread to all these ways of practicing. Lessening reactivity, lessening demand, lessening the push and pull on experience, lessening contraction, lessening dukkha as we do so. And when we, there's less dukkha, there's more well-being. Yeah, that's the positive side to that. Yeah. Does that make sense? Is that clear? I know I've been repeating it about 5 times already, and yet still. Can we see that? So another way we can speak about this, and another kind of angle that we can bring in to the cultivation, is that all of this is in support of equanimity. These are all ways of cultivating equanimity. And if you may remember, and I keep meaning to write the paramis on the notice board and forgetting, maybe I'll get to it tomorrow or tonight, the 10th parami, equanimity. So it's a quality that ends up in a lot of Buddhist lists, always at the end, the last one. And the Buddha spoke about equanimity as the kind of closest thing to nirvana, to awakening in the human experience. So a quality that is available, accessible to us, but it's got such a range of depth and subtlety to it. Like, you give us that taste. And one way that we like to speak about equanimity is non-demand, the opposite of the demand of clinging and craving. Or that kind of open hand, again, that we were practicing today. So with the metta flavor, especially towards the end of the practice today, this afternoon, it's a real flavor of equanimity. Welcome to arise. Welcome to be. Welcome to go in its time. Metta and equanimity meet. And I want to say a little bit more about this quality of equanimity, because even though equanimity is an English word, it doesn't make a lot of sense to native English speakers either, as far as I've been told. It's not a commonly used word or concept. And in the teachings, equanimity, as I said, has got this non-demand on experience, and also this sense of balance, steadiness, and an evenness of mind and heart. An evenness of mind and heart. In the Tibetan tradition, they sometimes speak about it as being equally close to all things. Equally close to all things. And like metta, it's an intentional quality. You might say it's the intention, to be equally close to all things. I love that. Another way that equanimity is sometimes spoken of is as dispassion. Dispassion. And that can be misunderstood or confused with detachment. Sometimes we think or feel that equanimity is actually detached, distant, disconnected from things. And that's part of why I love that equally close to all things, because it reminds us, no, it's not detached. It's not disconnected, it's actually equally close, equally connected. And if your mind is kind of going, how is that even possible? And getting into a twist, then it's really like, this is where the remembering the poetry, feel kind of what it feels like in the heart and the being, rather than what it means in the mental capacity. Remember, it's like an aspiration and an intention. So one of the beautiful things about equanimity, about dispassion, is this sense of a long view and a big perspective. And that's some of the etymology of the word upekkha, which is translated as equanimity. To look over, to have a big perspective, a big view. And equanimity also has a sense of connection. It's actually a feeling of connection that is less self-referential, less for me, less about me. It's again a beautiful aspect of the teaching. It's very much the spirit of the practices we did today. We practice in the morning with the Vedanas and with the sense of the compassion with the unpleasant, appreciation with the pleasant, the metta with the neither nor. Kind of relaxing, dissolving that sense of the Vedanas. As we've been saying, they come with the subtext for me. Pleasant for me, unpleasant for me. And this kind of dissolves that self-reference. Well, that sense with the metta, that all sensations are equally welcome, to appear, to stay, and to go as a cultivation. And everything, that way of looking, that everything that arises is arising to be met with kindness and with care. So equanimity as that lessening of reactivity. And that's where I find that language of dispassion actually very useful. Lessening of drama in our lives. And a lessening of that obsession that we have with things. Become less mesmerized, less obsessed by object, whether internal or external, and by the habits of push-pull on them. So equanimity also has this great sense of vastness and of stillness. So as you can see, it has a lot of different flavors and facets. And that vastness and stillness can contain the whole world, inner and outer, in its joys and in its sorrows. So vast, so still, so peaceful, that it can contain the joys and the sorrows, inner and outer. And if this feels kind of like lofty or kind of unconnected to your experience, then let's use some poetry and some experiences that most of us have probably had to kind of give us a taste that it's not as far away as we may think it is. Because it's definitely the kind of stillness and vastness that we can feel in nature. And again, if you haven't spent time with any of the big trees here, go and stand under a big tree, and you get that sense, of that deep stillness and vastness that can hold and contain anything and everything. It's also, of course, something that we access through meditation practice. It's one of the great gifts of our practice. As it deepens, you can find these depths of stillness, of peacefulness, and of vastness. And as I've kind of been mentioning a few times, I was trekking recently in Sami land and, coming up to high places, and then the vastness of the views in every possible direction. Views as far as the eye can see, without one human-made thing in sight. And that kind of sense of that vastness that we can get in nature, that reminds us, that same stillness and vastness is also within us. We are also part of nature. It's also within us. And I wanna go to one of my favorite poets. Last time I resisted a poem, this time I'm not going to resist. And this is by Wendell Berry. And he could have written this poem today, but he actually wrote it quite a few decades ago. And it's called The Peace of Wild Things. And it talks about this deep stillness and peacefulness that we can find and be inspired by in nature. And so he says, "When despair for the world grows in me, and I wake in the night at the least sound, in fear of what my life and my children's lives might be, I go and lie down where the wood drake rests in his beauty on the water, and the great heron feeds. I come into the peace of wild things, who do not tax their lives with forethought of grief. I come into the presence of still water, and I feel above me the stars waiting with their light. For a time, I rest in the grace of the world and am free." Resting in the grace of the world, in that long view, in the stillness and vastness that we can find and feel externally as it mirrors the possibilities internally. And I think nature is such a great teacher because we get that sense in nature. But of course, if we think about, you know, nature, it's not all peacefulness and harmony, is it? Yeah. There's sickness, there's aging, there's death, there's conflict. Yeah, all that exists in nature, and yet, yeah, it's all included. There's space for it all. Yeah, space for it all. Equally close to all things. Yeah. Equally close to all things. So this kind of depth of stillness, of vastness, of perspective, of non-demand, of inclusivity. We can feel it in nature, and we can also feel it in the depth of meditation. It's something that we can cultivate, discover, reveal. And sometimes the questions can arise, you know, is it possible to live this way? Yeah. And what about preferences? Do we have to give them up? Am I not allowed to like chocolate anymore? Yeah, or vanilla, whatever it is that you like. Yeah. And so the reminder, that it's about how we hold things. Yeah. And with all these teachings and all these meditative experiences and unfoldings, it's what we learn, it's what they teach us, and it's kind of how we apply those teachings to our lives. So it's about how we hold things, about the range of modalities that are that become available to us. And it's about knowing and tasting for ourselves the well-being that is available for us through the letting go of clinging and the letting go of dukkha. And the letting go of demand, and the letting go of contraction. Equanimity as non-demand. And we can be deeply nourished by equanimity. We can be deeply nourished by non-demand and by that equally close to all things, which, yes, is non-preference in one way. Yeah. And we can still have preferences as we move through the world. We can still have an inner compass of right and wrong, yeah, of wholesome and unwholesome. So we can be deeply nourished by that non-demand and non-preference of equanimity. And we can move through the world with our preferences, with our inner compass, with our wisdom. Yeah. And we can keep investigating and exploring what opens up, what's possible. Recently, kind of been remembering a lot this phrase from a Tibetan teacher called Sokni Rinpoche, who kind of invites us to look at our experience and to see it as real, not true. Beautiful middle way. And for me, it's an embodiment of equanimity. So we're both respecting, yeah, our experience, yeah, and honoring it. Yeah. Not saying, oh, this doesn't exist, or, you know, I practice non-preference, so I don't care. Yeah. We honor it, we honor what's arising, and at the same time we remember it's not true in the way I take it to be. Yeah? It's dependently arising, it's that again. Yeah? Dependently arising. So we find that middle way of real, not true, which opens up spaciousness, vastness, possibilities in us. And I want to give a little example here of kind of putting this into practice this morning in the first meditation of the day. I don't know if anyone else got visited by the same guest that I did, but I had a guest in the meditation session this morning. So I was sitting here and happily meditating away. And I heard a buzz and I thought, mosquito? And some people are nodding, so you also visited. And interestingly enough, sometimes this kind of cultivation of gratitude becomes really bizarre, but then my mind went, it's not what I wanted to tell you, but I'm going to go down this route anyway. It was like, oh, wow, good on you. I thought all the mosquitoes were gone. You know, here you are. Yeah. And then it landed right here. Third eye. Landed right here. So obviously wanted my attention. And I sat with it, and it was, you know, just so interesting, you know, it's like becomes such a practice opportunity and such a teaching, yeah, to just be interested in the sensations. Yeah? Just be interested in the sensations. And, you know, this is like, it's just a mosquito. It's a small thing. Yeah. It's actually not that harmful, but all the conditioning is there to just, like, as soon as the buzzing starts, let alone when you feel it landing, to just do that, right? And yet, it's possible, and this is a practice of equanimity, not to react. Yeah? Non-reactivity, non-demand. Yeah? Bringing interest to the sensations. Yeah, and they're interesting, because I can feel like, yeah? And then everything that follows. Yeah. And so practicing with that, the interest, the curiosity, the seeing the dynamic nature of the sensations, how they change. Yeah. Relaxing the contraction, this becomes very, very powerful because there's constantly contraction that arises. I don't like this, aversion, I want to do this, yeah, restlessness. All comes with contraction, relaxing it. Yeah. Saying to myself, real, not true. Yeah? So real, not true. It feels like this is really unpleasant, but that actually isn't that true. Because when I bring interest to that experience, yeah, it's actually quite fascinating. Yeah? And so I don't know how long it was. It felt like quite a long time. Yeah? Of being with the sensations, really interested, and using, you know, different modalities of practice, you know, mostly relaxing the contraction, interest in the sensations. Sometimes when the agitation would build, just that Vedana, you know, it's just unpleasant, yeah. And noticing how the sensations would fade and then come back again with more contraction and agitation and fade and come back again with more contraction and agitation. And then eventually I felt it fly off after I thought it was gone, you know, but still there for a long time. And then there was a whole other interesting realm of sensations when it felt like something was really kind of ballooning on my face. And again, you know, there's that urge, you know, to touch it, you know, to check, like, is this, but just staying with that non-reactivity, non-demand. Non-reactivity, non-demand. So it's a small example, but like I said earlier, you know, these small things that seem, you know, first of all, they make for a really enjoyable meditation practice. So let's not kind of like and think that's not worthwhile anyway, but also can seem small in the moment. So what? So you sat with a mosquito, yeah. But over time, the cultivation of that skill, yeah, and what it allows over time and what it prepares us for over time, yeah, is priceless. Yeah, is priceless in its preciousness. So we can be nourished deeply, yeah, by this practice of equanimity, by the non-preference and the non-demand of equanimity. Yeah. We can still have preferences and an inner compass as we move through the world. And that's ability to not take our experience at face value. Yeah. And if it's helpful, that Sokni Rinpoche whispering in your ear, this is real. but not true in the way you take it to be. What else is possible? What else is possible? And as we're deeply nourished by the non-preference and non-demand of equanimity, we can taste the well-being that comes from this capacity not to react, from the stillness, the vastness, and this way of being that is equally close to all things that opens up for us. So equanimity does not diminish our care or our capacity to act for the well-being of all. It's really important to say that, because often these teachings are heard, yeah, or felt to say, no, just keep your distance. Does not diminish our care, does not diminish our capacity to act for the well-being of all. It's quite the opposite. It resources us, it aligns us, and it strengthens us deeply. So there's many, many ways of developing and cultivating equanimity. And as I've been saying through this talk, we've already been practicing many of them. And on this retreat, we're emphasizing equanimity as non-reactivity and non-demand. And so tomorrow, you know, we're going to work with a particular lever. Yeah, remember those levers, those collection of things that arise with dukkha. Yeah. And that one is contraction. Yeah. Going to work with cultivating the sensitivity for when contraction is there and finding ways to ease and relax it. Because we can go directly to the contraction and relieve and release and ease, yeah, the clinging, the craving and the demand, and therefore the dukkha, through relaxing and easing that. So yeah, that's the trailer for tomorrow. And tomorrow we'll explore that, you know, beautiful, beautiful practice of easing, relaxing, contraction as a way of lessening demand and lessening dukkha and supporting the stillness, the vastness, the peacefulness of equanimity. Remembering as we do so, you know, this is a like all the skills, all the practices we've done, but maybe this one really, really supportive across life situations and life conditions. Yeah. We learn it and we apply it, something we can take with us everywhere. So yeah, stop here for this evening and have a quiet moment together to bring this to a close. If any mozzies appear, any mosquitoes appear, welcome them. And you can send them to me if you like. May the spaciousness, vastness, stillness of equanimity support each of us and all of us in our practice and our path. And may our practice together support the well-being of all beings everywhere. So thank you for your presence and your listening. And we have time for some walking practice in the coolness and the magic of the evening. And then we'll be back here for the chanting in just over half an hour.